It's time for Language Matters with Nat Benchley, WHDD's language guy.
Well, we're back with a few language matters because language still matters. You know, the more I read about this irritatingly irregular language of ours in blogs and magazines and books, the more I have to let go of old theories, prejudices, and rules, because the language is fluid and mutating all the time. Now, I may rail against many of the changes, but some will just have to be accepted. For example, in a review of a new book about the evolution of so-called proper English, the author is quoted as saying, quote, "Too often, the mavens and pundits are talking through their hats. They're guilty of turning superstitions into rules, and often their proclamations are nothing more than prejudice representing itself as principle," unquote. And that acceptance of fluidity seems to be the current trend in language studies. So I doff my hat rather than talk through it, and I will make attempts, some more successful than others, surely, to be less than totally rigid in my pronouncements. And I'm sure that our own tiny little gotcha gang will keep me apprised of any far-flung follies. Still, there are times and places when, and where, certain usages can be certified as wrong, or at least unnecessary. Speaking of unnecessary, in today's discussion, the redundancy bunch will tautologically and superfluously restate, repeat, and reiterate meanings, ideas, thoughts, musings, clauses, and contemplations while simultaneously at the same time wasting word space, pixels, ink, and time. And then we'll rehash it again once more. So let's start with a couple of the most often heard redundantly repetitive sillinesses. How about 2 a.m. in the morning? Okay, it certainly beats 2 a.m. in the afternoon by a long shot, and it's so easy to clean up. Or perhaps they both share in common. No, they share, or they have in common, or they both. Unless they both are sharing with other parties, the two of them only need one of the shared experiences. Same thing for both parties agree. Either the two parties agree, or they both maintain, declare, believe, whatever. Or the common, everyday, ubiquitous, come on from advertisers, a free gift. Well, sure it is. And if it's not free, it's not a gift. But apparently, the two words are individually so powerful at attracting customers. Free is apparently the most attractive word. A gift for you. That some copywriters feel it beneficial to resort to extraneous overkill repetitively. Or another favorite, they trooped in one after the other in succession. Well, I'm sure they did, because it would have been hard for them to troop in one after the other simultaneously. A very common one. He had his whole future ahead of him, as opposed to his poor brother, whose whole future was behind him. A population of 250,000 people. Now, this is admittedly nitpicky, but it's still overkill. That's what the population is, people. Now, the word can be applied to other groupings, but then it has usually already been redefined. So saying the rodent population of Hamelin was several thousand rats is superfluous. Or she crashed her car accidentally, as opposed to her brother who kept crashing his car on purpose in an apparent attempt to draw attention to his bad driving. Now, we all remember that the infamous wordsmith Yogi Berra said, "It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future." But here's an example from an NPR interview with an author which made my few remaining hairs threaten to leap off my head. She said, quote, "This book won't happen again in the future," unquote. And barring a grotesque case of plagiarism, she's probably correct, if slightly overstating. This does, of course, remind me of the great quote from that really wonderful wordsmith, Gene Weingarten, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post, who said recently, "If you spell enough words wrong, it isn't plagiarism." We also have this brief anecdote from a story about Abraham Lincoln, describing the fact that Ulysses S. Grant was supposed to be with the president at Ford's Theater on that fateful night in 1865. Quote, "Grant later became president himself 4 years later," unquote. Now, that particular example is so easy to correct that it really signals to me sloppiness on the part of the writer and, if such there even was for this book, the editor. Another favorite, "Open 7 days a week and weekends." Thank heavens. I wouldn't want to miss days 8 and 9. No, sir. Those are special. Now, to show how easy it is to get caught up in this trap, we offer here a rare lapse in construction from an eminent writer, who shall remain nameless for the moment, who, in describing the strange occurrence when John Adams and Thomas Jefferson expired within hours of each other, said, quote, "Both men died on the same day, the 4th of July, 1826, unquote. Again, the two men died on the same day, or they both died on the 4th of July. It's just so easy to clean up. So now that we've opened your ears to the fingernails on the blackboard effect of redundancies, perhaps we can see or hear less of such bites as foreign visitors from another country, unanimous agreement of all members, both were twins, a thin veneer, to exactly pinpoint, essential prerequisites, a new beginning, a close confidant. We first began, sharing the same point of view, the final ultimatum, a winning streak of 8 straight games. And to really put a fine point on it, I particularly think that fellow countryman is redundant, but I'll get argument on that one. Enough. I'm not really sure quite to what we should attribute this, since it occurs in spoken English about as frequently as written, but obviously there's a certain element of inattention, shall we be polite, involved. A lack of thinking about what one is saying or writing. And obviously, there are few editors left to catch any such bad things. But some of those are so common and so wrong that we must wonder at the patterns inherent in their frequency. I guess, once again, it comes back to my plea to all of us to try to open our ears and eyes to the potential elegance and clarity in accurately phrased English, even of the American variety. So, Jill, any favorite tautologies, redundancies, or repetitive rephrasings?
And also?
Well, yes, indeed.
But I have an answer to your rhetorical question, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And it goes back to, if you cannot dazzle them with brilliance.
Overword them.
And I think that in the overwordage, what is happening really is blah, 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 blah.
Exactly.
And it's synonyms. I had a friend, actually, and it was kind of a joke because he always did it in threes. Always. Whatever it was. There was synonym, synonym, synonym. And I, when I started writing horoscopes, just as a running inside joke, would do the same. There's a huge difference in knowing that you're doing it,
right,
and doing it as a verbal tick or a...
Or cover, you're right.
Yeah.
It's when people are uncomfortable or speaking beyond their comfort zone that they will use too many words rather than making it precise and clean and...
And keeping it succinct.
Yeah. And simple. Yeah.
And so that's my theory behind it. It's just so many of them now have fallen into common
use. That's the other problem. Yes, a lot of these things I cite are so common that people
don't even notice.
A lot of people will sit up and say, what do you mean? What's wrong with that?
Right.
2 a.m. in the morning, so?
Right. And I just wonder if, this is a scary thought, do certain people no longer know what AM stands for?
Oh, wholly possible. I'm sure that they just think it's part of the time thing. And then now, to be fair, when I was young, my parents used to ask me what kind of car I might like someday. And I said, I have to have a red Lincoln top-down convertible because I liked red. And Lincoln was the only car name I knew. And I knew I wanted the top to go down. And I heard convertibles were special.
Right.
So, yes.
Things like that can fall into
not being able to actually equate the phrases with what they mean. At the end of our segment here, I've just learned a new word, and I'm wondering if it's appropriate to apply it to this final segment, because sometimes it seems as though it might fit. The word is onomatomania, and it is defined as an obsession with particular words or names and a desire to recall or repeat them. Now, I will not own up to an obsession with words, but I will admit to liking the sound of many of them and a desire to use them constructively until they catch on. And speaking of doing things constructively leads me, in a negative way, to my other wonderful word for today, omphaloskepsis. And it means literally contemplation of one's navel, usually as an aid to meditation, but we all know how that can be used to goof off. It also means inertia, but I just think that, particularly as a potential inter-office memo header, it has great possibilities. Omphaloskepsis.
How do you spell that?
Omphaloskepsis. And it derives from the Greek word for navel or central point. There was at one point a point in the center of the Oracle at Delphi that was considered the center of the earth, and it was the Omphalos.
All right. Thank you very much. This has been Nat Benchley, Language Matters.
Because language matters.
You've been listening to Language Matters with Nat Benchley, WHTD's language guy, and Jill Goodman. Thank you.